and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
And now it's time for From the Streets with Bob Law.
You know, this is the official Black Friday was yesterday. Is that right? And the spending begins, even though marketers and businesses have been trying to encourage spending all year by having a Black Friday events all year long. But Friday, the day after the Thanksgiving holiday, is traditionally the day that the real spending begins. The pandemic has had some effect on that, I believe. And so there's not the same kind of mad rush into stores in order to shop. But the shopping begins. The spending begins. For some people, particularly in the African-American community, the spending has never stopped. We're going to take a closer look at the spending, smart spending, and black dollars. Kind of walk through some of the statistics that we have about what is called the power of black dollars and what is called the power of spending, and whether or not spending is representing any kind of real power. It's going to be an interesting conversation, and then we're going to remember and move into a conversation that remembers that next year, y'all, there's going to be an election in New York City. Next year, someone is going to run for mayor. Is the black community in particular prepared for the mayoral election next year? There are city council seats that are up for grabs as well. Are we ready? Have we given any thought to who and what the issue should be? We want to take a closer look at what is at stake with the mayoral election next year. We're going to take a closer look at what it is we should be requiring of Biden-Harris moving forward. It's going to be an interesting conversation. You're invited to be a part of it as we move from the streets with me. I'm Bob Law. On a Saturday morning in the city, a bright, sunny Saturday morning. Not bad weather. Looks like it's going to be a really nice day. I want you to move in a little bit closer to your radio. Everybody, move in closer to your radio. Let's begin this conversation. You know, Wendy White is a financial consultant in Richmond, Virginia, with over 10 years of experience across accounting. She also hosts a regular podcast, Wendy with an I, on YouTube and on SoundCloud. And she joins us this morning as we begin to look first at smart spending and smart spending and black dollars. It's an interesting idea. Smart spending. This is the season that spending really begins. But as we look at the statistics, the statistics continue to point out that black folk are outspending everybody else in the country. Spending more and more money every year. The black consumer spends, now we are spending into the trillions. I believe that in 2019, last year, black folk were spending $1.4 trillion and is expected by 2024 to spend $1.8 trillion. The increase, and they point out that the increasing influence of African Americans in the marketplace is another reason why the movement toward racial equality will keep gaining in traction. In 2019, African American buying power stood at $1.4 trillion. And that's where one of the questions come up. Whether or not buying is power, whether or not spending is power, how do we really look at it and begin to understand the use of money and as leverage and as power? And again, Wendy White joins us to kind of move this conversation forward. Wendy White, are you with me?
I am. Good Good morning.
Good to have you with me.
Happy Saturday. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm pleased to have you with us. Let me just kind of move into the conversation from your perspective. You were raising the issue of smart spending and black dollars. How so? How do you see that?
So I am one of those people that I have over the years prided myself with building my team. When I say my team, any type of resources and the way I spend my money around African-American community. Everybody that I do business with is a person of color, and I try my best to keep my dollar in the African-American community because it is so powerful. If we listen to what society tells us, we're only 12% of the population, I believe, in the United States, which I really don't believe, especially with the spending dollars that you just said that we spend as African-Americans. The problem is that the African-American dollar does not stay in our community like it does other cultures. And that's the problem. We spend so much money. Why would we not want to keep it in our community? It's important to keep the dollar within the community because that's how you grow, your community. That's how, you see Black-owned and, small businesses around your communities, especially in New York. There's a lot of regentrification. And I've been to Harlem and to the Bronx and places like that, and you can see how the community is changing. And, it's important. Like, even here in Richmond, it's so important to keep, the black dollar. I go to so many pop-up shops and African-American farmers markets and stuff like that because, that's where all your local business is.
Now, here's the question for us. One of the questions we're dealing with is understanding spending. The dollar, the African-American dollar, all the research, all the studies, like I'm looking at a study from Nielsen, and it says African-American U.S. buying power. All throughout the studies, it says they talk about African-American buying power. But if you don't spend the money, I want to say intelligently, if you don't spend the money strategically well as intelligently, your money does not really equate to power. You're just spending. Mainstream manufacturers across other industries are also looking at the opportunity to create specific products that appeal to diverse consumers. And then the report goes on to say, not so surprisingly, African Americans have cornered the ethnic hair and beauty market, ringing up 54 million of the 63 million total industry spent. Now, the whole industry with ethnic beauty products generates $63 million. That was back in 2017. But of the 63 million, 54 million came from black folk. Now, there's an article in that I've referenced before. There's an article in the Sunday Times about the ethnic hair market. And it points out that while black folk dominate as consumers, black folk don't own anything in the ethnic hair care market. That the stores are owned by Asians, the distribution is controlled or owned by Asians. The manufacturers of the products like Revlon, they are, for the most part, the major manufacturers of ethnic hair care products are white corporations. Black hair care manufacturers barely supported, wind up going out of business. But it is still called black spending power. It may not be spending power at all if it does not contribute to the growth and development of the black community. And I think that is the point that you were making. Is that right?
Yes, and it's so funny that you say about like Revlon. If you look at these white companies, they've done a good job in marketing towards African Americans. When I watch the news or TV or anything with advertisement, you know, you see natural hair and you see a brown skin person and you see them promoting an African-American hairline because, like the numbers that you just said, they understand the spending dollars of African-Americans and what they spend. And like you said, African-Americans are so powerful. If they understood that they can create their own, you know, create your own product, create your own manufacturer, you know, do things within your own culture and build instead of, you know, working for other people and giving them, you know, your dollars. It's unfortunate that, you know, the African-American hair, you know, it is ran by the Asian community, you know, but who's to say that African-American couldn't go and buy a store and, you know, sell products? I see it all the time online where it'll be like the first African-American hair store in a certain area or something like that. You know, more of that needs to happen. More African-Americans need to get into entrepreneurship. And, you know, they have these great ideas about hair products and, you know, just things that Black people would love. They need to create that and, you know, start a business, you know, start their own, manufacturing and their suppliers and stuff and building those relationships, because that's what's been going on for years in other cultures.
We're talking with Wendy White. She's a financial consultant. She's live with us from Richmond, Virginia. And we're looking at the spending that is beginning to take place starting yesterday. But as we look at the spending on the part of African Americans, it becomes clear that African Americans have been spending enormous money long before Black Friday. We didn't wait. We don't wait for the holiday season. We are spending all the time. And part of that enthusiasm for spending is based on the manufacturers, based on industry, referring to the Black spending as power. And so Black folk are very pleased in many cases to hear these numbers of how much money we spend. That's our spending power. But we don't really get anything in return for the spending the way other communities do, get investments in the community, get things done in partnership with the corporations. That doesn't happen in the African-American community. The report says that African-Americans make up now 14% of the U.S. population, but have outsized influence over spending. That means that we make up 14% of the population, but we outspend the total population, and we overspend on what are called essential items such as personal soap and bath needs. African Americans spend $573 million. Feminine hygiene products, we spend $54 million. Men's toiletries, $61 million. We're talking about in a year. Nielsen research also shows Black consumers spend $110 million on bottled water. That's 15% over all spending. We're spending more than anybody else, than the whole country, on overall spending. And we're looking at $587 million on refrigerated drinks. That's 17% over the amount that the total population is spending. Non-essential products, such as women's fragrances. African Americans spend $151 million out of the $679 million industry total. The total money spent on fragrances, women's fragrances, is $679 million. Of that, African Americans spend $151 million. We spend consistently on watches and timepieces. We spend $60 million on watches and timepieces. You know, this now, and even on children's cologne, that's left at $4 million on children's cologne. We're talking about in a year. And so there's a great deal of spending going on, but somehow that spending does not participate in or help create any kind of power or wealth in the Black community. We make the money, and we're pleased and proud to make this money. And then we spend it, and we are pleased and proud to spend the money. But we don't seem to have given any thought to smart spending. So, Wendy White, if we look at smart spending, your idea. So, again, can we just kind of walk through how you see what would be more appropriate for in terms of spending on the part of African-American consumers?
I think one of the best things that we can do with African-Americans is to seek out, you know, those small Black-owned businesses or, you know, businesses of color, and put your dollar into their businesses so that you can continue to grow your community. I think about, like, I used to buy Tide, and it's a Black-owned company that is detergent, and I cannot think of their name off the top of my head right now, but they're on Amazon. And instead of me buying Tide, I buy their African-American, you know, I buy a Black-owned detergent. I don't buy bottled water anymore from the grocery store. I have a client that sells bottled water out of D.C. It's alkaline water. His company is called Indulge. Like, I spend money with him to promote, you know, Black businesses. I do my best as a consumer to buy Black. And that's not a problem, because in other cultures, they do the same thing. They support their people that look like them. So as consumers, the best thing that we can do is start replacing things that you buy. Like, I have, like you just named feminine products. I buy products from Honey Pot. She's Black owned. I want to support her. You know, I replace things that I normally would buy that, you know, from a large corporation, and instead I've replaced it with Black owned items. And you can just do that periodically. You know, you don't have to do it all at once, but you can just start replacing things in your household and buy Black. You can also, you know, when you go grocery shopping, you know, go to a Black-owned farmer's market, you know, seek out, you know, a Black-owned farmer in your community, or, you know, a Black-owned grocery store, you know, seek out those things, promote and love your culture. That is one of the best things that we can do. And also educate. You know, I spend a lot of my time educating people of color and just people in general, because it's not that they don't want to do it. They're just not aware. And a lot of times, you know, in certain communities, they don't have the need or the resources to get certain things. And they just need to understand it to be able to do it. Because I've been natural since 2009. I have done the whole wave of buying, you know, African-American products, because I couldn't buy the regular products because they weren't for my hair. And so I spent all that time researching and trying to understand. And that's another thing. You have to research these companies that you spend your dollar with, because unfortunately, in the times that we're in, a lot of companies know how to market towards African-Americans, but they're not African-American products. And so you have to do your research when you are spending your dollars to make sure that it's an actual African-American company and not somebody that is just putting on a face as if they're African-American company when they're not. So it's just really important to, during this time that we're shopping during Black Friday, you know, I do my best on my social media. All I've been doing is promoting Black-owned businesses this whole weekend and posting them. You know, seek out those Black-owned businesses. Go to, you know, go down to, you know, like we have different areas in the city of Richmond. You know, go down to those farmers market and those pop-up shops and, you know, promote, support your own. It's so important.
Very important. Now, one of the things that occurs to me is that the new younger emerging generations or generation of Black folk, younger Black folk, from millennials on up to maybe people in their 30s and 40s, seem to have be receptive to the idea of supporting Black businesses and trying to support each other. Earlier generations, folk older than that, they would always push back. I'm not going out of my way to support no Black business. That's really not what you should do. Treat everybody the same. You know, I don't really look for who owns it. Some of my own I can't trust. We would hear that a lot early on in the late 60s and into the 80s. You hear that a lot, trying to encourage Black people to spend within the Black community. Tony Brown, who is a brother named Tony Brown, who used to preach that all the time. He would point out how other groups live off two incomes, their income and our income, that we are spending all of our money. We spend 2 or 3% of our money within our own community. But there was resistance to that. Now, you've just pointed out that you spend a great deal of time preaching that same message of do for self. How are people responding to that now? What is the attitude? What kind of an attitudes do you encounter?
So I am in the millennial category. So I'm a late 80s baby. I have gotten such positive reception to discussing Black businesses. So I actually I do my podcast, and then I also did something called Wendy Wednesdays with my friend Markeisha, who owns a app called Blocal, which is like a Black directory. I call it the modern green book, because it's a directory that you can go online and it's an app. You go to Blocal and you can actually find Black owned businesses in your community throughout the United States. And when I've talked to people, a lot of times when I'm talking to people, you know, a lot of my friends, if they're talking to me, they're like, hey, Wendy, do you know such and such? And I will tell them, like, hey, I know this business, try them. You know, one of the best things we can do is word of mouth. And as Black owned businesses, or just having any type of business, you know, you want to be a good business so that people will talk about you for free. They will post your stuff because they like it and they want to support you. I love supporting Black businesses. I love talking to entrepreneurs. Black people are so passionate in what they do, and they love doing what they do, and they love giving back to the community. I went to A&T, so I went to HBCU, so I have tons of people that I went to HBCUs with, that type of network, and we are always, on my timeline, that's all I see is people promoting Black-owned businesses. I remember it was 2 weeks ago, I talked to two women who were starting businesses, and that excited me because I love hearing about people being entrepreneurs and small business owners. That's amazing. You know, I love promoting and talking to people, and they're very receptive. Like, they want to know the information. And a lot of times they don't mind paying that extra money because, you know, a lot of times people don't understand. When you have a small business, your prices are sometimes higher because you don't get those low rates that you would because you're a big box company. You know, they get, you know, lower shipping rates, and they're buying larger quantities, so their price of their pallets and stuff are lower, so they can charge you a lower price. But I don't mind spending that extra money because I know where my dollar is going to, and it's going to promote a small Black-owned business. And those are the heart of the community. Those are the people that go and, you know, when you're sitting in your local cities and you're talking about local government and stuff, those are those small businesses that are impacted when there are grants and projects and things that are happening around the community. Your small businesses are affected by that. And that brings revenue to your city.
All right, Wendy Williams, I appreciate you being with me. Your podcast is called Wendy with an I. Is that right?
Yeah, my name is Wendi, so Wendy with an I podcast, and it's on YouTube and SoundCloud, and I release it every Monday, and I talk about entrepreneurship, and, you know, I'm an accountant finance background, so I'm all about educating people of color about finances and accounting and how important it is to have that foundation to be strong in the community.
All right. Now, I appreciate you so much. I appreciate you spending this time with us this morning to kind of get this conversation off the ground in the air. Wendy White, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. We'll call you again. We're going to continue this whole series of looking at the cost of being Black in America and how to spend our money strategically as well as intelligently. So I want to invite you to come back from time to time to help us move this conversation forward. Again, thank you so much for being with me. I'm Bob Law. This is From the Street with Bob Law. We're at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Regina Smith is standing by. Everybody, moving a little bit closer to your radio. Money, 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 indeed. It is about money. It is about how we spend the money that we already have. You know, we are poor people. Black people are poor. We're so poor, we can afford to spend $54 million a year on hair products. poor people. You can afford to spend $152 million a year on women's fragrances. It's supposed to be poor. You know, we can afford to spend $54.1 million on feminine hygiene, $62 million on men's toiletries, personal soap and bath needs. We spend $573 million in a year. Frozen, unprepared meat and seafood, $761 million. Supposed to be, but we're poor people. My mind. How can poor people afford to spend $12,000 a day in the fast food restaurant? You spend about $12,000 a day in each McDonald's in the black community. And but we're poor. Malcolm said you've been took. You've been had. You've been bamboozled. There's a mayor's race coming up next year in New York City. Are we ready for that? Have we given any thought to that? Do we know what it is that we should require of the candidates for mayor? And we are celebrating the fact that Biden-Harris won the election and that there is a black woman as vice president in this country for the first time. As I pointed out to someone yesterday, that wasn't Biden's idea. That was Jesse Lewis Jackson's idea. 1984, Jesse ran for the presidency and announced that his vice presidential mate would be a woman if he won the Democratic primary. He forced Mondale to select a woman as his vice presidential running mate. That came from your brother in 1984. It's another topic. We're going to talk about that as well. Regina Smith is the executive director of the Harlem Business Alliance and a lifelong Harlemite. Regina Smith, welcome back to From the Streets with Bob Law.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you. Good to have you. The I want to just begin here. We're still talking about money. Let me just ask it. As we're looking at, before we look at even at, well, I guess at the same time that we look at the mayor's race in New York City coming up next year, or maybe just a step before that, what should we be requiring of Biden and Harris?
Oh, we have to require that they put together a black economic agenda within the first 100 days, and that it be specifically targeted to black people, not to minorities, not to people of color, not the low-income communities, not the MWBEs, which stands for Minority and Women-Owned Businesses, but to black people. Black people are responsible for their victory. We need to understand that. We need to realize that, and we need to demand what is due us and has been due us for quite some time.
Let's give some thought to that economic agenda. I don't know if Biden and Harris are even ready or capable of developing that agenda. So people like your organization, the Harlem Business Alliance, and forming a national coalition have been working on that economic agenda. What kind of things should be are included in there? What is it that actually speaks effectively to the needs of the black community?
Well, first and foremost, dated money. Okay, so procurement is extremely important in a primary economic vehicle for white people in this country. And so we have focused on procurement, federal, city, and state procurement opportunities. So on the federal level, we are saying that a large portion, over $500 million, needs to be targeted to black communities, and it needs to go through a vehicle that is created by black people for black people. And what this entity would do in the organization that we're working with, that we have formed, that you referenced, the Black Business the Black Business Empowerment Commission, has been diligently working with individuals and organizations across the country, because we found that we are all in the same boat, that our businesses aren't thriving. You know, you spoke about that during your first segment. Not only are our businesses not thriving, we have an extremely small percentage of businesses across the nation. So that's one of the first things that needs to be addressed. We need to get a sizable portion of procurement dollars. In the federal government has trillions of dollars to spend, and we need to make certain that Black businesses get a good portion, a sizable percentage of those contracts.
Interesting. The goal overall is to close the wealth gap in this society, in this country. And Blacks make a lot less. We generate a lot less money. We earn a lot less money, not as a result of any errors in judgment or apathy on our part, but as a result of policy decisions. Right now, let's shift to New York City for a moment. Right now, in terms of those procurement contracts, what percentage of those contracts do Black developers get now in New York City?
I believe it's definitely less than 5%, closer to 2%, maybe even 1%. What we found particularly disturbing, particularly during the pandemic, was that the city spent billions of dollars, and those dollars went to, over 95% of those dollars went to white businesses that were owned by white men and white women. Collectively, white men and white women received over 95% of those billions of dollars of emergency contracts here in New York City.
Now, their pushback will be that there aren't any Black businesses that were able to accommodate that. There were no Black businesses that they could do business with.
But as you stated, I mean, we know that that's not true. I mean, we were on the phone. We were pushing, for example, our Black restaurateurs here in Harlem who also cater. There were numerous food contracts that were let. And so we said that in Black communities throughout this city, Black restaurateurs should get prime contracts to feed Black people in Black communities. But that didn't happen. So if you weren't positioned, if you didn't have a relationship with these various city agencies, their procurement officers, they didn't bother to look at you because they didn't have to. And, of course, they could always say that they needed to select somebody who had the experience. But our caterers, our restaurateurs, they have experience doing this kind of work. They're really, and there were a number of companies that actually received contracts for PPE equipment that pivoted and started making masks. You know, they hadn't done that before. We certainly have the talent, you know, in the wherewithal within our own community to do that kind of work. But there was no interest.
Let's walk through that again. What, like the masks, for instance, because they say that, well, we couldn't find a Black company. You're pointing out they also couldn't find a white company. So, but the white companies who did not make masks began to make them, and then they began to get the contracts from the city.
Exactly. And if you knew somebody within the administration, then that just, of course, made it that much easier. And oftentimes we don't have those networks. We don't have those relationships. They haven't been cultivated. This city hasn't mandated, really, that Black businesses be engaged on any level. So they constantly talk about MWBE goals, but that's a group that is comprised of anyone who's not a white male. So you have white women in the group, you have Asian businesses, you have Hispanic businesses, and you have black businesses. So they always talk about, even on a state level, trying to exceed a 30% goal. But that 30% goal is oftentimes made up primarily with white women companies, followed by Asian companies. And then Latino businesses, they get some of that. And all the way at the bottom are black businesses.
Now, I wonder, what is the rationale for the black businesses being at the bottom of the list? Well, how do they justify that?
Well, they really don't have to justify it, because everyone in this city and most of our leaders, whether they are in foundations or nonprofit organizations or whether or not they are elected officials, tend to speak and use terminology that really doesn't highlight what is happening to black businesses. So when they ask, well, how are minorities doing, and the city responds, well, minorities are doing fine, it's because they don't demand that the data be disaggregated so that they can see how poorly black companies are doing. And in terms of the number of contracts and also the dollar amounts. And that's on the city and the state level. If you don't ask the question consistently, and if you don't demand that you receive an answer that is in direct response to your question. So if I ask you a question about black businesses and you answer me and you tell me how minorities are doing, you're not answering my question. And that has been extremely effective, unfortunately, here in New York. And it has to stop.
We're talking with Regina Smith. Regina Smith is the executive director of the Harlem Business Alliance. Regina Smith is a lifelong resident of Harlem. People who have been born and raised in Harlem like to point that out. They want you to know I'm a lifelong resident of Harlem. I have an aunt. She was a Harlemite through and through. She wouldn't even call the new names as the streets would change and Adam Clower Boulevard. My aunt said, no, that ain't no power. That's 7th Avenue. She was a purist, a Harlem purist. And Regina Smith is helping us kind of walk through this whole issue here of black dollars and the strategies necessary to close the wealth gap, to actually revitalize the economy in black communities. Part of the problem with that is black people being included in the minority category, which does not really address the realities for the black community, because the black community is not where it is through errors in judgment. The black community is at the bottom of the economic list as a result of racist policy directed deliberately toward the black community. And as a result, that community is in need of a strategy that is going to repair the damage that has been done by the deliberate policy decisions to denigrate and do harm to the black community. We're going to spend some time here at least with on the streets here at WBAI. We're going to spend some time looking at the realities of economics and economic revitalization in the black community and why we are where we are. It is not because we have done all the wrong things or simply because we spend the money recklessly. It is because of the policies that deny black folk, the policies that are summed up as part of the black tax, the cost of being black in America. We're looking at that now. Moving into next year here in New York City, there's a mayor's race coming up. But just before that, one of the things, Regina Smith, that you mentioned is that if you don't get the right questions, if you don't really understand the trap of that minority category, if you will lose out. But you just kind of mentioned in passing, but the leadership, the folks that we have at the city council, you know, the folks that, particularly the folks we have at the city council in New York, it seems to me that it is their responsibility to raise the right questions, that it is their responsibility to work with your, for instance, the Black Business Commission to present the Black Business Commission's economic agenda to the city here in New York City, to inform businesses as well as consumers as to what is actually going on and where the trickery is. What about those elected officials? Am I right that they simply don't do the job?
Well, before we formed the Black Business Empowerment Commission, we formed a group called WAY. And I would like your listeners to go to our website, waynyc.org. And we talk about why we formed. And we formed because we knew that Black people were in a horrible state of affairs, that they were in a state of crisis. And that we represented about 22% of the population, and we had 2% of businesses, which made, you know, so we knew it was horrible. So we started talking to the city about a Black economic agenda. So what we need to do with our elected officials, and yes, you're right, oftentimes some of them don't understand small business development. They don't understand economics. They think small. So when white people are thinking about procurement in the hundreds of millions of dollars, they may think that $1 million is a lot of money. And they're thinking that they need to be inclusive and they need to be concerned about minorities. And we already spoke about, you know, that trap. So. We have to, what we need to do is to make certain when we have discussions with candidates who are running for office, city council, mayor, that we ask targeted questions. What have you done to promote Black businesses? What financing, what capital have you made available specifically for Black-owned businesses? What organizations have you funded to provide technical assistance, intensive business counseling services to help Black people who want to create, sustain, or expand their businesses? What have you done or what will you do specifically for Black people? And we have to listen to their answers, and we have to demand that they answer our questions directly. So those are the things that need to be done because they haven't been held accountable. These questions haven't been directed to them by enough Black people because, as you stated, we've been bamboozled. We don't understand how horrible, how bad our predicament is. And the fact that for any community to thrive, you have to have a strong economic base. You have to have a strong business class. That impacts the well-being of the entire community. It positively affects, you know, your health, the type of health care you will get, the quality of education your children will get. It's just critically important all the way around. So, yes, that has been a problem. Our representatives haven't really understood how critical it is for Black people to own businesses. Some of them have felt that if we increase the number of jobs, you know, we get more Black people in to work for these various corporations or for these chain stores, that you know, we were doing something. Well, I mean, a lot of people, they don't hire that many black people. So we look at these corporations, these white corporations, the number of black people or the percentage of black people that they hire is extremely low. If you look at Asian businesses, I mean, forget about it. They don't hire black people. If you look at Latino businesses, they really don't hire black people either. So black businesses hire black people overwhelmingly, over 75%, 80%, you know, 90% in some instances. We hire our own people. And that's why it's critical that we have thriving, growing black businesses.
To say this, we're talking again, we're talking with Regina Smith. She is the executive director of the Harlem Business Alliance. And if you want to join the conversation, we have a few minutes. Maybe we can get in one or two calls. You can call us at 212-209-2881. I believe that is the correct number. Sean, is that the right number? 212-209-2881. If you can...
No.
2877.
2877. Good that Sean is there. 212-209-2877. Plus, y'all know the number. You've been calling this number for years. 212-209-2877. We'll take your phone calls right now if you can get in. We only have a few minutes. See if we can get your reaction to the conversations that we've been having so far this morning. I'm Bob Law, and it is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. We're looking at moving forward. There's going to be a mayor's race next year. Have we given any thought to that? Are we at all prepared? The awesome black vote, is it standing by to vote for whoever? Or have you given any thought to what we should require of the people who are going to be seeking your vote, both at the mayoral level and at the city council level? And we have some real serious issues at both levels. The mayor, the quality, the competency, the qualification, the criteria for being mayor. And we have some of the, I wouldn't say that. I'm not going to say that. We have some of the most incompetent people in the city, in the city council. I won't say that. But we have a need. Well, I don't know why I won't say that. We certainly have a need to upgrade the quality of those folk who are serving at the city council level. Regina, before we go to the phones, tell the website that you mentioned, your group's website, say it again.
It's WEG NYC, so it's WEGNYC.org. And we have questions. We have a section on political accountability and questions that black people need to ask politicians. So we have a page there. And so we think that, an informed community is what we need. We need our people to be informed. They need to understand what's at stake. They need to understand how important it is that we own black businesses and that we grow them and that we hire one another. You had Sean Rochester on talking about PhD, purchasing black, you know, depositing in black institutions and, you know, hiring black. These are things that we absolutely have to do in order for us to thrive and to make certain that we earn enough wealth to pass on to our children. We have to be we have to improve our condition so that we can improve the condition of our children and our grandchildren. It's imperative.
Yeah, I'm going to the phones. We'll take a caller. Your website points out that white-owned firms to receive over 90% of COVID-19 contracts as black-owned firms receive leftovers. 90%. And that's a policy decision. That's what Sean Rochester was talking about, the cost of being black, the things that we are denied, that we are capable of responding to and handling. And 90% of those firms go to receive over 90% of COVID-19 contracts. I'm Bob Law. The phone number here you have, 212-209-2877. Hello, we have a caller with us. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, I'm calling from Manhattan. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I'm getting a little echo, but anyway. Thank you for having people on that can talk about solutions. Because a lot of the programs I watch on TV, like Gilchrist Experience, Community Cop, these are black men that always talk about the problem, but they never discuss the solutions. So even though, and I'm more prone to men, I guess maybe as a woman, you have two women on with solutions. I give you credit, but I wish there was a brother somewhere in there that can talk. But the, one of the things I wanted to say also, I live in New York City Housing Authority. And the people who work for NYCHA, the ones who clean the buildings and so forth, their hands are so tied. They're so busy trying to clean outside the building that they never get into cleaning the inside. And so people who live in NYCHA, if you're listening, and maybe, Bob, you can do, I've been listening to you way, way, way back when you was on 1190. We need to start. NYCHA has what's called tenant participation activity money. This is money that HUD gives us, but they're not giving it to us because every unit, every apartment, they take money from your rent to make up that fund. And I've been speaking about this forever on every radio station that'll listen to me. NYCHA has like 400,000 tenants or something like this here. And we're sitting around looking all poverty-stricken, like the woman just said about the economics, a strong economic base. And we have the money, but we're not doing nothing with it. Our buildings are nasty. They stinking. They disgusting. And then we want to sit around and talk about white supremacy and all this kind of thing here when the ball is in our stinking court. And we're not doing anything with it. So we can start. This is a solution.
Wait. I'm going to run out of time entirely. You have effectively changed the subject, but I want to get back to where we were, and I'll come back to your concern. As you said, we're going to do series. We're going to keep this series going, raising these kinds of questions. But I don't know if I have another. Is anybody else holding on?
Yeah, you have another call.
All right, let me take this other caller as we promised. We try to get in at least two calls. And we're about to run out of time. There's another caller with me. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, Bob, certainly appreciate your show, the previous guest and this guest. Ms. Regina Smith, thank you so much for this Black Business Alliance. My question to you is, what happens when we ask the right questions in terms of black-owned businesses being at the bottom and avoiding that minority trap that they always catch us, you know, and giving the money to minority-owned, identifying them as white women and other people and not black people. So how do we fight that kind of racism to make sure the work that you're doing will be able to show the black community that we can be able to get the resources that we need and the tax dollars and the monies that's due to us to start on our own businesses? I really appreciate your organization. I will look at the website and get information on how I can educate myself. And I also like to say that it's good that we have a Charles Barron out here in East New York who seems to approach those developers that come in our community not to exploit homeowners or gentrification. How do you feel about pairing up with progressive elected officials to make sure that we are pushing the agenda of the Harlem Business Alliance, which you so have articulated and put together for our community? Thank you, sister. Thank you very much. And Bob, thank you. Longtime listener.
We did a series on political accountability, and Charles Barron was one of our speakers. He's excellent. He was absolutely on point. So that's what we have to do. We have to start holding our elected officials accountable. So we're going to be paying attention. And I think black people are more aware now, especially coming out of this federal election. I mean, you know, the presidential election. And paying attention, and I think that we'll be able to focus this type of attention on these candidates, And as we move forward, I believe that the awareness and understanding is going to increase as well, so that we will be able to track these elected officials' performances. And if they don't perform, then we have to do something that we haven't done in the past, and that is to run candidates against them and to vote them out of office. So we can't continue.
Wait now. As often happens, we raise the right question at the end of the show. We raise the question maybe where we should have begun. That music in the background says we're out of time. Regina Smith, thank you so much for spending this time with us. The website for Regina's organization, WEGNYC.org. You can go there for additional information. Again, thank you for spending this time with us. And thank you all for staying close to your radio on this Saturday morning with me. I'm Bob Lowe. We'll be back next week. Thank you for being with us this week.
WBAI is not only a progressive free speech radio station,
but it is also your opportunity for several perks through the BAI buddies.
That was good. That was smooth.
Donate as little as $10.
All right. I'm hanging up.
Thus forming a relationship that benefits you,
the listener, and us here at 99.5 FM. After becoming a buddy, you'll receive a WBAI tote bag and a membership card that enables you to enjoy discounted services at Zipcar, Bacchus French Bistro, Revolution Books, and more locations in the New York region. Simply visit give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And donate today. We are a listener-supported radio station, but as a buddy, WBAI can also support you.
Snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Audio Stages is taking a few weeks off from our regular fare of original radio musicals to take you on an excursion into another world. We've all heard stories of battles between good and evil, between villains and heroes, in the real world over property. But then there are stories about battles fought in the spirit world, also between good and evil, for the possession of human souls. Tune in this Saturday at 7 as Audio Stages launches an historic rebroadcast of Rider at the Spirit Bell, Episode 1, the first of three, set in a blend of time and place, in the present and in an ancient world. Rider will transport you to places where you may have been without even realizing it. Rider at the Spirit Bell, Episode 1, WBAI, this Saturday at 7.
Extinction Diaries. A small and shy Florida grasshopper sparrow, born and raised in captivity, is flying with tiny transmitters so scientists can track and quickly learn what is pushing the bird towards extinction. The transmitting sparrow's mission is to save the 30 last breeding pairs in the wild. Florida grasshopper sparrows have been declining for decades, but in 2000, their numbers dropped sharply and continued to do so. The source of their rapid loss remains elusive. Once the captive-raised transmitting birds mate with the wild ones, scientists hope a more complete picture of the grasshopper sparrow's activities will lead to solutions and survival. The sparrow almost vanished as Florida real estate consumed the once vast prairie. Now they may be the next bird to go extinct in the U.S. if